This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In the 60s, it was psychedelic and protest rock. In the 70s, there was prog rock until disco took over. And then in the 80s, punk rock exploded.
All dressed up, we can cool our heels. She's just a valentine of velvet rock. Kissing black and gold snake men. She'll suck the coins and bills from a sock. Something to spend now and then.
That was the openly gay punk band Red Wedding, a group Greensboro's Billy Ingram knew all about. He covered the Los Angeles punk scene for a local gay publication back in the 80s. He saw the growth of bands like Black Flag, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and the Minutemen. But while he was watching a revolution in rock, he was also witnessing something else. He found out what it was like to be openly gay in a music scene that wasn't friendly to homosexuals, and he tells the tale in his latest book, Punk. Billy Ingram joins us now in the studio. Welcome back, Billy.
Thanks, Frank.
So what was your introduction to the punk scene?
Well, I was working at Data Boy magazine, and at that time, it was a gay magazine that went out every other week to all the gay bars in Southern California. And I noticed that they were just printing press releases. They didn't care. They didn't care about the content. They just cared about selling the ads. So I asked the typesetter, GDZ, I said, why don't we write a rock column? You know, because they're not going to pay us, so we can say anything we want. You know, we can cover any band because the gay people don't care about punk anyway. So let's just, you know, mess them up. So I think one of the first shows I saw, it was at the Starwood. I'm not sure if you could classify Grace Jones as particularly punk, but she had a punkish act. And it was just eye-opening. Here was this you know, androgynous, harsh woman with, you know, very harsh features. And she had this, you know, straight-ahead Jamaican kind of punk thing. Well, during the first show, she just jumps into the middle of the audience and starts beating this guy on the head with her microphone. And I thought, wow, that's fascinating. And we went to the second show, and she did it again.
Same guy?
No, different guy. Okay. I didn't stay for the third.
Good.
It might have been
that's
me.
That's good. So what was it like? Because actually, you were sort of in on the ground floor. Punk was just sort of beginning, kind of late 70s,
70s, 80s. Well, 76, yeah. It started in L.A. What was really beginning was that the punk bands that had come up before were starting to get more melodic, because punk was just sort of a straight ahead, rah, 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 wild in the streets, yeah, kind of thing with no melody. And after a few years of doing that, they started thinking, well, we need to branch out. And so the whole post-punk movement started around 1980. And the band you just played was Red Wedding. Their previous incarnation, Hey Taxi, they were the openly gay punk band. And then after that, they sort of realized that you just can't keep on doing that same one-note kind of thing. So they evolved into Red Wedding, and you hear what that was. It was really actually also the beginning of the goth scene. They were one of the first goth bands.
And you're describing that and you also managed a band that was
Red Wedding. I did end up managing them in 83 after I stopped writing the column. Yeah.
But punk was not necessarily friendly. These were not compatible communities.
No, but the interesting thing about it was you had what I was covering was the East L.A. downtown scene, which was emerging because you had the Chicano rock down there, Los Lobos, Los Plugs, the Undertakers, and bands like that, really hardcore bands. But they were also trying to mix, the white scene, you know, get the white kids in there, get the black kids in there. So they were opening up clubs and warehouses and stuff. There was a club called the Brave Dog that opened up. And it was a very friendly scene. And I didn't see any real resentment about my being gay. But then again, I wasn't really, you know, very queenie. So I'm not sure that they really knew that I was gay. But, at that point, I didn't care whether they did or not. And everybody just got along. Everybody got along great. I never saw any fights. I never saw any arguments. It was a wonderful scene. It reminded me more of the hippies in terms of the attitude than what you think of as punk.
Well, what about the band itself? I mean, if you think about a band, you know, like Red Wedding, how did they thrive, or did they thrive in a scene? Did they have to be outside gay communities to be successful?
No, they thrived because the music was good. And that's what people were interested in, was the music. And that's what it was all about in that scene, was the music. And that was it.
You call the book Punk. What is this book? It's a collection, really, of some of your thoughts and some of the pieces that you were doing at the time.
Yeah, it's a collection of the articles that I wrote on the scene. And it's also essays on what it was like to work at Data Boy, what it was like to be gay in the 1970s. I asked Michael Ealy, who's the lead singer of Hey Taxi and Red Wedding, if he would share what it was like for he and Spider Taylor to live together in the 1970s as an openly gay couple, and they encountered a lot of hostility, a tremendous amount of hostility. And it's surprising to think that, I mean, the police were busting up gay bars as late as 1976. So it was a very strange time because there was a lot of oppression that had been going on. But by the time I got there, I didn't know anything about it. So I was all carefree, la-di-da. And when I go to the gay bars and we're all having a good time, the older guys would be sitting at the bar and just shaking their heads because they missed out.
They missed out. You couldn't get away with that.
No, you
couldn't. So things had changed a lot.
Things had changed a lot. In fact, in 1967, the police burst into the Black Cat Lounge on New Year's Eve. And they busted everybody in there. It started a riot. But they arrested two guys in the back for kissing on New Year's Eve. And they were convicted of being sex offenders. And they took that case all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court refused to hear it. So in essence, you had no constitutional right for a man to kiss another man or a woman to kiss another woman. So that just emboldened the LAPD. And they would just go, if you put your hand on the shoulder of another man in a gay bar, one of the undercover cops would arrest you.
Wow. And those arrests would result in convictions? They'd stick?
Very often. And then now you're a registered sex offender.
Wow. Well, you also got involved with prostitution at one point.
Well, I didn't. I myself didn't. But yeah, we had a wider range of clients. We had pornographers and we had businesses, you know, but also some male prostitutes. I remember one, Gene Carrier, who was known as Johnny Harden, would come in and we'd do catalogs for him and ads for him. And people would order his pictures and his films and that type of thing. It was odd.
Yeah, so you're having to do that. But you did have a role, albeit off camera, in a porn film.
Yeah, well, one of our clients was Larry from Trademark Films, and I would do his video boxes. Now, the weird thing about the pornography at the time, in 1980, the price point for VCRs fell below $1,000 because people started buying VCRs, and in L.A., there are a lot of perverts. But the porn movies before that, you had to buy a little 7-minute film and put it on a film projector and project it on a sheet or on the wall or whatever if you wanted to watch a porn film, no sound. But then video came along in 1980, and it revolutionized the business. So I was designing the first generation of full-color video boxes for these films. So Larry comes in and he says, Billy, can you do me a favor? I got a recording session tonight for my movie. Would you do the voice of Kip Noel, the star of the movie? I go, of course I'm not going to do that. That's ridiculous. He goes, please, Billy, I have a lot of money invested in it. I said, okay. You gave me $100. We're going down there. It's going to take an hour. Even today, $100 for an hour isn't bad. So I went down and did it. They showed the film, and I pretended to be the main character in the film. It was just awful. I can't even explain it to you. The film's called Coming of Age, and I won't spell that for you. But yeah, I did that. I was ashamed. I never told anybody about that before this book because I never told anybody about the work at Data Boy. I couldn't show my work because a lot of it was sexually explicit or it was gay.
What was there actually a script or did you just make sounds?
No, there's no script. No, yeah. No. Stood there by the microphone.
But this is interesting because it's sort of like talkies comes to porn in the 80s or something.
Yeah, it did. In 1980, they started to move over to at video so that you could have sound because 16 millimeter, unless you cared about the product, was very expensive to sync sound and video.
Right. So you also document the tragic end of roller disco.
Well, I don't spend more than a couple of sentences on it. I think a half a sentence. But yeah, well, there was a big roller disco palace in L.A. that everybody knows about if you live there. Flippers. It was owned by Cher and Olivia Newton-John and a couple other people. And the business, you know, when I moved to L.A., everybody was roller skating. I mean, you go to parks and they had vendors that would rent you roller skates. So people were skating all the way. So the roller disco thing came in. It was really, really big. But by the end of 1980, it had just disappeared. And so they said, well, let's start booking some punk bands. That sounds like a great idea. Well, after the first show, the floors, those state-of-the-art floors were ruined, you know, with the jack boots and the chains and people with spikes falling on the floor.
What's amazing is a decade of roller skates, right, does nothing to these floors. But one night with a punk band in the audience.
Yeah. And well, you know, they were geared for the for the wheels. You know.
That's a lot different. You ended up with somebody who could have killed you.
Yeah, I could have been. Well, yeah. Well, I had a client. We had a client. His name was Eddie Nash. He ran the Starwood, and that was my favorite rock venue. And Eddie Nash, it is alleged, because he wasn't actually convicted of this, that he and Johnny Watt and Eddie's bodyguard went into a home on Wonderland Boulevard, Wonderland Avenue, up in the hills, and bludgeoned four people to death and left another dead. And bludgeoned them with a threaded lead pipe, which left the bloodiest crime scene in L.A. history. Which is, when you think about the Manson family and all these other people, that's pretty astonishing. Well, so after this crime happened, the police go to Eddie's house. He's a suspect. And they break in there. They find some items from the murder scene. They find him in possession of $1 million worth of cocaine. So they prosecuted him on the cocaine, thinking that would be a lock. And Eddie argued that that was for his personal use, and he actually prevailed in court and only had to do 2 years in jail for $2 million worth of cocaine. So a few years after that, he owned another club called the Starwood, the Odyssey, which was a teen disco, gay teen disco. And just like the Starwood before it, the neighbors petitioned the city to shut it down because people were fornicating, defecating, urinating in their yards, doing drug deals. You know, there's a neighborhood that backed up the club. So finally, they did shut the Starwood down. And the manager of the Starwood called me and said, "Billy, we're going to start a rock club here. Do you have a band that we can?" I said, "Yeah, I'll get Red Wedding there for you." He says, "Tonight?" I go, "Yeah, okay, I'll get them there tonight. I'll give you $100. Okay. So they go down, they do the show, and I go to the manager and I say, "I'd like to get paid." He goes, "I'm not going to pay him." And I was, "That's not acceptable." He said, "Well, you have to talk to the owner." So I go upstairs and knock on the door and go in, and it's Eddie Nash and his bodyguard. His bodyguard looked like that monolith in 2001, you know? He was just big and square. Right. And I said, "I brought the band here, and I'd like to get, I'm not going to pay you. I didn't make any money." I was like, "Well, that wasn't the deal. You know, I brought the band down. If I have to pay him out of my own pocket, I will." Finally, I shamed him enough that he peeled off, five 20s and told me to get the F out of his club. His bodyguard stepped up to me and everything, But had I known about the Wonderland murders before, I wonder if I actually would have just taken the $100 out of my pocket.
Yeah, I'm just saying, standing there saying, "Eddie, I'm not leaving until you give me my $100. And yeah.
And then the club burned down that next week. Eddie's thing was, he was the nightclub king in L.A., and probably 16 nightclubs. But when he closed a nightclub, he torched it. So he could get that extra little bit of money.
It is one of the great stories of Hollywood, the story of those murders and the retaliation and the porn star
really
who is kind of at the center of that. One of the incredible stories. So how and that was a time. I mean, that was what was happening at that time. These were sort of quasi-legitimate businesses. Porn stars were really stars of a porn industry that had was a gray industry, let's say.
Well, it hadn't really emerged because the guys who were making porn movies before that, they were selling these little films, like I said, and you could only charge so much for a little film, 8mm film. So when the videos came in today's money, it would cost you $250 to buy a porn movie. And if you wanted to rent one, it would be $50 in today's money. Mm. So you can only imagine the money that was flowing to these guys all of a sudden. And it was just like opening a spigot.
But it was all – was it all one big scene where all of these people hanging out at the clubs?
Oh, I don't know. I don't – about the porn people, no. I just saw them when they came into the office. I had zero interest in any of that.
When you look back on that time now, how has the music – I'm talking about live music industry. Has it changed much, do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what really changed was at that period of time in the late 70s, early 80s, kids in L.A. and other big cities wanted to go see live music. And right about 83, 84, the rave club started, the underground club started, and the DJs became the stars. And suddenly nobody wanted to go. Even I didn't want to go to see the bands anymore because I'd seen so many. And, you might have to sit through if there was a bad band on the stage, you'd have to sit through that for an hour before you could get to see the band that you want to see. Meanwhile, you go down to the Nairobi room and Matt Dyke is pumping it. And that changed everything.
What was it like to manage a band back there in a city like L.A.? I would think it's very competitive. Obviously, you've got niches. You know where to market your stuff. But what was that like?
Well, it wasn't terribly exciting. You just contact the clubs I did press kits and that type of thing. When Red Wedding's last album came out, Nails, it was a tremendous hit on the college circuit. So that really helped us. And plus, there are a lot of outlying cities around L.A. And Red Wedding was very, very popular in San Diego. So you really had a tremendous number of venues. You had hundreds, literally hundreds of rock venues in Los Angeles that needed bands. So you could get gigs. And you could, sort of package the gig with your friends' bands,
Your column had a fairly large audience. Was it tough for you to stop doing it?
No, I walked away. I burned bridges like candles. I just walked away from it. It never occurred to me that anybody was even reading the column.
Were they?
Yeah, they were.
I really only discovered
that today. When people were contacting me, "Yeah, I read that column." Some of my friends that didn't even know that I'd written it. "Oh, I used to sit out 17 years old and hanging out at the Motherlode, and I'd sit and read those columns."
what about rock journalism? I mean, you open the book, a kind of epigraph, Frank Zappa's famous quote. I'll leave it to you to quote it. But
I don't remember the quote exactly.
Oh, well, it is rock journalism is people who can't write interviewing people who can't talk for people who can't read.
Yeah,
Frank Zappa.
That pretty much summed up what I was doing. I mean, when I started writing the column, I didn't know the difference between a bass player and a guitar player. So that shows you, you know, the level of my musicality. I was an actor, so I knew how to judge performances. So I felt like I could do it on that. But after seeing bands, you know, for months and months, and I started to have a keen eye for who the good people on stage were and who weren't.
So, and of course, the theater of punk was it had to be more important than the music. So that's really what.
Yeah, I mean, it was like theater. It definitely was like theater. Yeah.
Billy, always a pleasure to talk with
you. Thank you so much, Frank.
Billy Ingram is the author of the book Punk, and you can find out more information at tvparty.com. Thank you for listening to our program. If you have a comment about the state of things or you want to hear an archived edition of a past program, our website is stateofthings.org. And our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Stella Strohmeyer is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Our managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.